Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, that's pardes.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Hi, everybody. Good morning. We are still in the figure of Moses Mendelssohn, the irony being, of course, as I said before, that's where we're supposed to start. But because he's such an emblematic character for the Jewish Enlightenment, and we will indeed talk more about the Haskalah in this class and the next. But I want to bring him back into the story because he's not gone yet, and because his spirit lives on in the Jewish Enlightenment, in many ways, on to this very day. So big picture, what I want to do today is I want to talk about emancipation. Last week we talked about Enlightenment. And emancipation is a parallel process which plays a very important role in Jewish history and in the birth of the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment. Then I want to specifically speak about what's known as the Berlin Enlightenment, which is the origins of the Jewish, I mean, it's also Berlin Enlightenment in the secular sense, but the Jewish subset of the Berlin Enlightenment. That'll probably be where we get to. I mean, there's a lot between those two. Jewish story. Mendelssohn, you know, there's two things I want to take away from the discussion we've had already. And that is, on one hand, it's important to remember, especially through the lens of how he's been characterized, that Mendelssohn never gives up on a sense of obligation to the tradition. It is a mistake to characterize, as he's sometimes characterized, Moses Mendelssohn as the first Reformed Jew. And we will speak next week about the Reform movement. He is a reformer, small r, right? But he's not a Reformed Jew. And just so you can get a sense of it, here's a great quote. "I cannot see how those born into the house of Jacob can in any conscientious manner disencumber themselves of the law. No sophistry of ours can free us from the strict obedience we owe to the law. And reverence for God draws a line between speculation," meaning philosophy, "and practice which no conscientious man may cross." So the question is how is it that Mendelssohn becomes characterized as someone who is a sort of like antinomian force? He's the ultimate lawbreaker in the minds of Orthodoxy, which of course doesn't exist yet in our story. Let's remember that, right? In traditional Judaism, right? One of the answers is that because if you look at the numerous grandchildren that come from his line, right, the vast majority of them end up as Christians. So that is an important question. Even some of his children. I don't know about the numbers there, so I was...
Two remain Jewish.
Great. So, I mean, that's definitely out of... Considering he had 10 kids, so that the percentages there aren't so good. So that's one side of his character. Was that a question? Or you just... No. The other side of his character, however, comes with the fact that he will engage in a battle with the rabbis of his day. Right? It's quite a fierce battle against rabbinic power. Not rabbinic authority, rabbinic power, meaning the use of censorship, right, cherem, the communal ban, which were important tools that were used to sort of enforce norms and hold back what they perceived to be the sort of invasive tide of Enlightenment culture. Right? So he would fight that fiercely in his day. And I want to use his character in that sense to just present to you something. I don't know if we've spoken about it here before, but it's, in my eyes, critically important to understand, is that what Mendelssohn is doing is he's struggling with the continuum between authority and autonomy, right? So on one hand, he sees the law as an absolute authority. And on the other hand, he sees real human consciousness or conscience, depending on how you want to look at it, as a product of autonomy, right? Remember, dare to know, right? That was Kant's version of enlightenment, right? And that human nonage is the sort of unwillingness to use one's mind in the face of the world. So as a philosopher, Mendelssohn not only is wedded to, but believes deeply in the critical importance. One could go so far, I don't know that he ever said this, but could go so far as to say that he sees the Tzelem Elohim, the truly godly within the human being, as the autonomous side. Which, by the way, it may be bucking the trend from the Middle Ages, but in many ways is consonant with even many religious thinkers of the 20th century. It's an interesting thought, but he's a man ahead of his time. On the other hand, he sees the law as binding. So how does one reconcile these two? Because here he's going to fight to uphold the authority of the law. At the same time, he's going to fight to deconstruct the power of the rabbinic establishment in order that a person, and what's his ideal? That a person, in an autonomous, free sense, chooses, or at least recognizes, choice is a funny word, recognizes that they are bound to the law. Well, these two, by the way, are an important aspect of everyone's lives. I'm sure this strikes you in your own life or in your understanding of Jewish history as relevant. Anybody who's ever raised children is probably familiar with the dynamic here, right? So what's important to recognize, of course, is that both of these are poles on a continuum, and as is often true, the extremes on any continuum are myths. They may be important myths, but they're myths. They don't exist in their absolute sense. There's no such thing as absolute authority. And I can tell you as a rabbi who every once in a while someone comes to me and asks me a question. Rabbi, am I allowed to do X? You might think, well, that's the ultimate giving of authority to me. But first of all, they choose who to ask. Don't ever undervalue that. Second of all, in today's day and age, 99% of the time they've checked Google first. Right? Third of all, are they even going to listen to what I tell them? Right? Because in the end of the day, and I've had this discussion with people, you know, not when they're asking me what to do with the spoon they stuck in the milk pot, but when they're asking real questions, then just realize that your sense that God said so doesn't remove your moral responsibility for what it is that you do. That's actually the essence of halakha. Halakha is a behavioral system which is meant to allow you to embody your values. But if it's not your values that you're embodying, then it is meaningless. You cannot offload the problem of authority. So authority in its absolute sense is a myth. No human being can give it over to someone else entirely. Autonomy, however, is also a myth. I mean, aside from the fact that we're all part of the biosphere, and if you think that, you know, no man is an island is a cliche, it's still true, right? On a deeper level, just recognize a person whose absolute value is autonomy can neither learn nor enter into committed relationships. Because the act of learning and the act of real relationship is a giving over of some of your autonomy to someone else for some reason, because you believe they know, because you care what they think, whatever it is. So these two are important myths, right, on a continuum. And what's beautiful is most of us live our life oscillating between the two in the nature of the relationship and our sense of being, etc. But you know what happens when you oscillate in a healthy fashion between these two? You know what emerges in the middle? Authenticity. Right? Now, authenticity, you may think, is a terribly modern or postmodern sense that we're all trying to be authentic. But there's a beautiful sort of disciple of authenticity of Rav Simcha Bunim Mipshis, who is a Hasidic rabbi in the 19th century, right? Which is not so far from where our story lies. This sense that, and I think Mendelssohn deserves it as well, is that on one hand, he sees human conscience as finding its greatness in autonomy, dare to know, right? Don't live a state of nonage. He is even a correspondent of Kant. On the other hand, he's a Jew. And as he says, notice the language, right? Right? Cannot see how those in any conscientious manner disencumber themselves of the law. He's more than happy. In fact, he advocates for a society in which one could do such a thing, but he sees it as a terrible failure. And the question going forward, and it's a question which is very relevant today, is does that work? Does that work? Because it worked for Mendelssohn, but apparently it didn't work for his kids and grandkids.
I guess I'm still confused, rather, because implicitly, authority means that you listen to someone
external.
Autonomy, that you listen to yourself.
Correct. This would be autonomous, heteronomous in that sense. Sorry.
But seriously, I mean, I'm still not clear how this is autonomy. If you learn, but then you're still forced to listen to authority.
You're not forced. That's why he will fight against the rabbinic power to use the tools of coercion. So the authority is vested in the law and in revealed tradition. You know, he's a believer in the Shulchan Aruch. Right? Those are authoritative texts.
But if you don't do it, how are you living under its authority?
You accept its authority.
But then you don't do what it says.
Well, no, but he did. He believed that one must.
So how do you have autonomy not to do it?
Because you choose to and you're not made to. It's a product of your conscious decision, which allows it to be an authentic expression of your values. This is a longer discussion that I don't want to delve too deeply into, but you're going to see that it's a frame for the struggle for a Torah to find a meaningful form in modernity. Because emancipation, as a general secular movement, is the sort of handmaid, or you can decide which one's which, but is the companion of enlightenment, right? If enlightenment was about these two principles of uncoupling knowledge from tradition and lifting the horizons of thought, right? So that's the sort of inner... So emancipation is about freeing the individual from the social and political structures that control their behavior, right? And so they too go hand in hand. And for the Jews, it's particularly powerful because the Jews in medieval Europe lived within communities of conscience, right? Religious communities, which also were embodied in corporate social and political entities, right? The medieval Europe did not want to deal with the Jews as a bunch of individuals. They wanted to deal with the Jew, the one Jew, and then within our own communities, we do our own thing. That's why the Jewish communities, often under the power of secular law, it held enormous legal authority. That if you were put in the ban and you violate the ban, in theory, at least, oftentimes the Jewish authorities could turn to the secular authorities to enforce it. Now, it was rare because that itself is a violation of Jewish law. But you understand that the power vested in the religious structures here is enormous. And listen, I've told you guys before, what do you get when you mix religion and politics? Politics, right? And so therefore, we call it batel b'shishim. Like, history has just proven again and again that human psychology does not change just because you are a religious individual. And so therefore, that the temptations and the complications of wielding power are no different for a rabbi who has absolute power within their community than they are for the president of the United States. So this is a frame in which I want to consider the sort of phase of our story that lies ahead. So the next phase, as I said, is going to be emancipation. And emancipation, for the Jewish story, really gives birth, as I think we've mentioned, to the Jewish problem. Right? The Jewish problem is not a new one, but the form in which we're familiar with it, and I use that phrase, the Jewish problem, because it was the Zionist movement that really popularized the phrase. And the Zionist movement is responding to a particular historical embodiment of the problem. I mean, the Jews are a problem, period. They're like, full stop. Jews problem. I mean, because we don't fit. To be a Jew is to swim upstream, which is one of the reasons we find it so hard to have a sovereign state. Because, you know, what happens, a dear friend of mine once started a yeshiva for all the people that didn't fit in other institutions, which is an excellent idea, right? And what happens when you take all the people that don't fit in other institutions and put them in one institution? Kablooey, right? It's called herding cats. It doesn't really work so well. It takes a very unique person and environment. So in the same way, we're, you know, look out the window. But the Jewish problem really is born out of emancipation because in the Middle Ages, it may not have been so good to be a Jew, but at least it was clear what it meant. You live within the sort of Augustine's model of the suffering remnant, right, who is both protected by the secular and religious authorities, but kept in a lowly, degraded state as a reminder of the proof of the truth of Christian interpretation of Scripture and the consequences of rejecting salvation. It's like very neat. Not so pleasant, but very neat. And you have a corporate existence. When you exist as a religious community, if you step out of that community, you either convert or you're nobody, although we spoke about Spinoza as the dawn of a new era. But that era, of course, depends upon the surrounding Christian society's willingness to accept a secular existence.
The same holds true in the Islamic world.
It's very true in the Islamic world. And the big difference in the Islamic world, of course, is that they never have to suffer the waves of the Enlightenment or emancipation, right? And which is why Zionism will come as a particular blow, because the political existence of the Jews is the threat to Islam, not the religious one, right? Christianity has a religious issue with the Jews, right? And so that the fractures in our relationship tend to be theological, right? I mean, obviously, theology doesn't exist in a vacuum. It has a sociology to it as well. But in Islam, religiously, there are some sort of tussles in there, but it's nothing compared to the political status. Jews having a sovereign state is the ultimate denigration of the system which existed for the 1,600 years before it. And if you don't understand the Arab-Israeli conflict as part of the mix, I would never sort of like reduce it to that. But you need to understand that as part of the mix, right? So yeah, it's a different story. For right now, though, we're in Enlightenment Europe, for better or worse. So the Jewish problem really is posed by emancipation, because as soon as the sort of civil, now it's purely the Christian society around, as soon as the Christian society around begins to deconstruct the corporate existence of the Middle Ages with the sort of first estate of the church and the second estate of the nobility, right, and perhaps a third estate of like the city, the dwellers and the burghers, etc. And it starts to break that all up. The ultimate destination to which this will head is what? What is the ultimate political product of emancipation? Yes, the nation state and the model of citizenship which goes along with it. Right, that the sort of end of the art, well, I don't know about end because the nation state is on the ropes right now, but the sort of interim end of this arc is the nation state in which citizenship cannot be separated from government, because there is a direct relationship between the individual and the state. Now, mind you, even in the nation state, we have to create buffers. We have civil society for good reasons. But nevertheless, that's the sort of idealized model. And in that, I want you to understand one more theoretical piece, which in certain ways parallels this. Max Weber, right? We've spoken about Weber as the sort of classic foundational sociologist. His definition of the nation state is the organization which has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force to maintain order. Because he sees a state throughout history as basically a system of maintenance of order, right? Force is the way in which that's done, or the threat of force. Right? And the difference between the secular nation state and everything which precedes it is that it doesn't presume to be divinely inspired or some sort of like materialist ideology, but rather presumes its legitimacy. Right? That legitimate is the fishy word. I'll say it again. It's an organization that has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force to maintain order. Now here's the catch, if you want to understand the 20th century, is that governments that we call autocratic, right, gain their legitimacy through their monopoly. You understand? Why does an autocratic government have a monopoly on the legitimate use of force? Because they get rid of everybody else who tries to use it. So their legitimacy comes from their monopoly. Countries that we consider to be democratic, small d, their monopoly comes from their legitimacy. Right? That's the model of the people, by the people, for the people. Right? You want people in a democratic culture, you want the people in uniforms with the guns, and ideally, no one else. Right? Now, this is one of the reasons that the tension in America, for instance, over gun control, issues of police violence, you know, go to the heart of the very unique situation in American Republic, the history of the American Republic, in which that was agreed upon as a least bad scenario. At the heart of American individualism lies a deep distrust of government, right? It, after all, was a revolution. That's a discussion for another time. But I want you to appreciate that this creation of a world in which there's going to be a direct relationship, to the extent that it's possible, between the citizen and government means now we have a Jewish problem. Because do the Jews count as citizens? Up until now, that hasn't been an issue. The Jews had their role as a whole. They were, like, to a degree, I told you last week, like a fourth estate. They exist outside. We talked about them in the Middle Ages as serfs of the king. We can speak about their relationship with the church. But now, we're sort of, as a society, we as sort of Christian Europe, are evolving toward a world in which the state sees its philosophical legitimacy, right, in the rights of the governed. Which means if you have a large body of the governed who don't have any rights, it undermines your legitimacy. That might sound familiar. So therefore, we have to ask the question of what to do with the Jews. And this is the Jewish problem. Right? And it really gets posed in our history toward the late part of this of the 18th century. I'll give you a story. In 1779, Moses Mendelssohn receives a letter. He got a lot of letter from lots of people. This one happened to be from a big Jew. Philanthropist, army contractor, leader of French Jewry, Serf Bear. Serf Bear was a very interesting character, and since we're not going backwards, I can just say he is the sort of the quintessence of the court Jew. Right? The court Jew was a model within Central and Western European Jewish culture where the Jews were not emancipated, didn't have citizenship, right? But there was always a big Jew who was able to get close to power, who either formally or informally represented the interests of their people, hopefully in an honest and helpful fashion, right? And in return for their power and wealth, they were granted effective citizenship. In fact, Serf Bur was given citizenship by Louis XVI in 1775, which is unique because if you open up the books of Jewish history, when did the Jews get citizenship in France? 1791, it was granted. We're going to talk about the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Man, but certainly not 20 years before him. Serf Bur. Sure. So he's got a problem because he's been waging, unlike many of the court Jews who use their position to sort of step out, as it were, he used his protected status to wage an unrelenting struggle on behalf of his brothers. And now he's starting to encounter some of those French Enlightenment thoughts that are claiming that the Jews are an unregenerate and unregeneratable element of society, and he needs a good argument for why the Jews should actually be granted citizenship, as he has been. And he writes, of course, to Mendelssohn, because Mendelssohn is the German Socrates, and he's well known at this point through intellectual Europe as a sort of shining example of what a Jew could be and as a sharp thinker. But 1779. But rather than replying directly, Mendelssohn hands it off. Maybe he was too busy. Maybe he thought that the answer would better come from a Christian rather than a Jew. And he hands it off to Wilhelm von Damm. Right? He's a Christian scholar. He's also a member of the government in Berlin. And he's a central figure of the Berlin Enlightenment, the Christian Berlin Enlightenment. Right, so the result was Dom's essay called "Concerning the Amelioration of the Civil Status of the Jews." It's a classic piece of Enlightenment sort of social philosophy, I guess is the best thing to call it. Now, number one, he insists that a state which is going to embody the Enlightenment values must leave the Middle Ages. It cannot be characterized in its treatment of the Jews by what he calls the religious fanaticism which had dictated government policy up to then. Right, what does he mean? He means that Christian Jew hatred, right, that sort of suffering servant model, is a product of a worldview that we want to leave behind. And he recognizes if they want to leave that worldview behind in general, this is a test case. What do you do with the Jews? And I want you to appreciate how important the Jews are. Not a sidelight to European history, right? Jewish history in Europe is often presented as a thread, and it can be. But my approach, and I believe the honest approach, is that the Jews are actually a central element of the evolution of Europe, right? And by the way, when Europe reached its final form, what did it do? It vomited out the Jews because they don't fit. Because what we're about to see is that the Jews in the pre-Christian era were the indigestible element of empire. We fought three wars with the Roman Empire to simply get them off our turf because we wouldn't play the game, right? That's three wars, two of which lay at the heart of what historians call the Pax Romana. I mean, the whole world had been beaten into submission and decided better Rome than anyone else, except for the Jews. Along comes Christianity, absorbs that sense that the Jews are indigestible, but transforms it in many ways to the fact that the Jews are the obstinate refusers of salvation. All you got to do is say yes, and then you can be part. And the Jews say, no, thank you. Right? And the next sort of 2,000 years of Jewish-Christian relations unfold. Along comes Europe, and they finally realize, gosh, that, what do you call it? Religious fanaticism just doesn't work. Now all we need to do is accept the Jews as, well, he says a Jew is more a man than a Jew. We want to accept the Jews as human, but there's a price. They have to stop being Jews. Because Dom's essay is a classic example of an entry into modernity which requires checking your culture at the door. Yes, D-O-H-M. Sorry, here. I can't even spell it. I have my notes there. So the Jews will go from being the indigestible element of empire to the obstinate refuser of salvation, to the alien other. Just the other. Right? And if you insist on being Jew, you will be other. And we will see that it has its roots specifically in the Enlightenment philosophy, which emerged out of the Jewish problem. How do we integrate the Jews into a secular humanist society? Right? So he, just to finish the point, he asserts the characteristics of the Jews that render them incapable of making any real contribution to the state, dubious morality, over-concentration in trade, deficiencies in general education, physical weakness. These things should sound familiar because they will become tropes of political anti-Semitism. All those things are just the consequences of centuries of discrimination. This is Montesquieu, if you recall. This Enlightenment philosophy that says that the environment shapes the human being. All we have to do to regenerate the Jew is change their environment. But of course, they have to cooperate by giving up on being Jews, because no one would ever assume that you would want to be such a thing. I mean, look at them. Ich. Right? And this is essentially what he says. So you can imagine that Mendelssohn was a little bit horrified by the results of his recommendation. Now, before we get to Mendelssohn's response, we have to note that Dom's essay was well-timed. It was published in Berlin in 1781, and only a few months later, over in Austria, Emperor Joseph II, right, starts to issue a series of edicts of toleration. First, it's for non-Catholic Christian sects, because he is a Catholic. He is, in fact, the Holy Roman Emperor. And then, within another year or so, I got the details here, what year? Oh, 1782, he issues what's known as the Edict of Toleration in Jewish history, which is the granting of Jews tolerance within his empire. Now remember, he's Holy Roman Emperor as well as Archduke of Austria, so this is a very big shift to have a major Catholic monarch who is offering Jews citizenship, not quite yet, and we'll speak about why, but real tolerance, right? But if you want to appreciate what this reflects, you just need to hear the prologue of the resolution, which states, "This policy paper aims at making the Jewish population useful to the state." Right? And as such, it's going to allow Jews to attend schools and universities. It's going to open up avenues in business, education. It's going to sort of take away the restrictions like wearing gold stars, which, by the way, is a product of the Middle Ages, not Nazi Germany. It was a throwback. Special taxes. However, the Jewish languages, Hebrew and Yiddish, are to be replaced by the national language of the country. Official documents in these schools would not be printed. They were forbidden, in fact, to be printed in Jewish languages, and immigration of new Jews into Austria would be severely restricted to those who are of economic use to this state. Right? So the Edict of Tolerance, on one hand, is a tremendous advance for the sort of freedom, and Jews at this point suffered under tremendous restrictions in the German states. At the same time, you can see that it is an embodiment of this sort of one path of solving the Jewish problem, which is that a Jew is more of a man than a Jew. Therefore, all you have to do is get them to check their culture at the door, and they're welcome to enter Enlightenment society. Right? And as sort of, I want you to understand, as a parallel to this, is that Joseph II is the emblematic figure of what's known as Enlightened absolutism. Enlightened absolutism is an interesting philosophy which has a surprising resonance, I think, in the human mind. And by the way, keep your eye out, because it's making a comeback. Enlightened absolutism, we come from sort of egalitarian democratic societies, whatever your personal opinions may be, that's where we come from, which have this Enlightenment assumption not only that all human beings are created equal, which they borrowed from us, but also that the least bad option in government is a government by the people, of the people, for the people, right? Meaning that the legitimacy of a government is through the consent of the governed, right? And there are all kinds of challenges to that. I'm not going to go to it now. But it's not the only philosophy which emerges out of... Right? People associate that with Rousseau and the social contract, if you're familiar. But there's another model of social contract, right? And that is the model of... originally, it was Frederick the Great, ruler of Prussia from 1740 to 1786, who wrote an essay, this was the style of the time, right, called Enlightened Absolutism. His protege, Frederick the Great, he was the... I don't know if he was actually king, he might have been prince, but a ruler of Prussia. You know, the German states, like king, prince, baron, it's all very complicated. But he was ruler of Prussia from 1740 to 1786. And his intellectual protege was Voltaire. Voltaire got in a lot of trouble in France since, you know, they were still in the model of, you remember the Sun King, Louis XIV? I am the state, which he may have never said, but he would have if he'd thought of it. Meaning, it's important. That is the classic medieval model, right? I am the state. So therefore, when they come to his descendant, Louis XVI, and they say the people are revolting, he says, who? Right? I mean, there's the church, there's the nobility, but I am the state. Who are these people of whom you speak? Like, they're just human fodder for my needs. Right? That is an extreme example. But the enlightened absolutism actually takes a different stat, sort of a different stance, that's the word I'm looking for, on that idea, is that the social contract is that a despot, an absolute ruler, is entrusted with the power to govern because they have the best interests of the people at heart. Right? It's an enlightened absolutism. Right? Give me all the power, and I will make your life better. I'll improve education, I'll improve the roads, I'll make the trains run on time, right? Well, there were no trains at the time, but you get my point, right? I will sort of improve commerce, I will sponsor cultural events and essay contests and museums and libraries, etc., so long as you don't presume to ask for any political power. Now, lest you... This is the argument invoked against democracy from philosophers from Plato on downwards. Don't forget, Plato is the one who gives birth to this notion within Western philosophy. The Republic is not a democracy. Who sits at the head of the Republic? The philosopher king, who is an absolute ruler. Right? Now, what's the operating assumption? That he's going to do good. And you know what the other operating assumption is? Even if he... Say it like it is. The operating assumption is that people are stupid. People are stupid. You don't want to give them power. The average person has a very narrow view of the world, very base instincts, and will only muck things up. Well, listen, whatever you want to say, like, by the way, go back to the model of American democracy. You know what the great fear, you know what the great fear of the framers of the Constitution was? It wasn't monarchy. You know what it was? Populism. And all kinds of the Senate, the Electoral College. The great fear of the framers of the American Constitution was not monarchy. They'd understood they won that battle because monarchy had no roots in their culture anymore. Populism, however, is always at the edge of democracy. Right? And so therefore, before we poo-poo this model of enlightened absolutism, we should understand that from a philosophical perspective, it makes sense. It's very neat and clean. Right? The fact that we're depending on this person to be enlightened and benevolent, right, is not such a stretch in their worldview because their experience of superiority, and this is the other thing, it's hard to imagine, right? You know, think of, Pharaoh thought that he was God. To us today, that's absurd. But just imagine waking up in the morning. You're the only person sleeping in a bed. You're clean, right? The mass of people around you literally exist in order to supply your needs. Like, at what point would it occur to you that you weren't God, right? That inner experience of power and rectitude is a self-referential point, which is hard to argue with. And plus the access to resource and education, et cetera, yeah.
But that's our model in math as well.
Well, not exactly, because the Hebrew culture is expressive of a very powerful division of power. It's true that the king... But if you look at what's called Mishpat HaMelech, right, the judgment of the king, meaning what does the king get to do, it gives him a lot of power. At the same time, the Sanhedrin has a tremendous amount of power. There's also an absolute separation between church and state, as we call it today, which is unique in the ancient world. The king had no place in the temple. True, he was the only person who could sit in the temple courts, right? That was only the king of the house of David. Right, and furthermore, there's an awfully strong, if not democratic, then at least populist element which exists in terms of how a king comes to power and how they receive their authority. And last but certainly not least, the institution of prophecy, which aside from the sort of like presuming to speak on behalf of God, you know what the real role of the prophets is in the Bible? It's an institutionalized place where you can speak truth to power. Right? They are, I mean, lahavdil thousand havdalim, but they're the press of their day. It's an independent institution whose purpose is to criticize. But the prophets do it in the name of God, so therefore they don't have to be a fool. Although it's interesting you note that, because, of course, according to the Gemara, when prophecy was taken away from the prophets, who was it given to? Fools and little children. For that very reason. So, okay, yeah, Chuck. The word democracy comes from demos and was not seen as a positive term in Greek philosophy, which is why democracy was not so popular. I don't know if I want to go into definitions of populism. I don't know that we've drifted a bit, although I think it's important to understand the context. I want to get back into the main line of the story. So this is the sort of political context in the early 1780s when the Jewish problem becomes pressing. And when you first get this enlightened response of, and I want to get them straight, one response we have, which we didn't mention, we'll go back to Voltaire, sort of representing the response of, what is the enlightened world going to do with the Jews? Is they're going to have to spit them out, right? Whether it's because, I'm just looking for my notes, I had it well laid out in like 3 points, and now I can't find it, which is always so annoying. Give me 1 second. Oh, come on. Okay, we're gonna look for it. They'll have to spit them out. Either it's because of this sort of quasi-racial element, like this pseudo-genetic perspective that science is beginning to produce that Voltaire was quite enamored of, the Asiatic peoples, right? Or because the neoclassicist vision, right? A lot of the Enlightenment wanted to skip over the Middle Ages and go back to Greco-Roman culture. Well, lo and behold, you crack open all the great books of Greco-Roman culture, and the Jews are the indigestible element. Like you thought that was a product of religious fanaticism. We're going to get rid of Christian medieval culture. And then suddenly you discover, wait a minute, one of the things they have in common is nobody likes the Jews. Interesting. Meaning you get a sense that they don't fit from a philosophical standpoint. And then you just can't discount the old school animosity. You don't shake that so fast. Right? There's only, 1,500 years. The average Christian did not hate the Jews from philosophical or religious reasons. The average Christian hated the Jews because it feels really good to hate somebody. And they've been trained to hate the Jews. And and having an other is a tried and true method of having some sense of self. And so it's like you can't discount that element, which has nothing to do with philosophy, religion. It has to do with human psychology. And the Jew will play a very important role in that psychology within Europe. So there's that one school, which is basically the Jewish problem is solved how? By getting rid of them. And as we'll see in the end of the day, one of the questions that Europe to this day has not been willing to answer is why is it when you broke down all the walls and emancipated your society, it went ahead and created the greatest massacre that humanity has yet known? If not in numbers, certainly in the cold, systematic approach to social engineering. Right? So that's one perspective. The other perspective will be, no, the Jews are more than welcome to join the club so long as they aren't Jews. Right? And that will lead to either the sort of, we saw a little touch of the conversionist, because the secular assumption is a Christian secular assumption, or it will lead to the assimilationist approach. And we're going to see that the reform movement in many ways is a response to that in complex levels. So that's the second. Either you got to get rid of them, or you're welcome to join, check your culture at the door. Then you have Mendelssohn's response. Because Mendelssohn was, let's just say, horrified by the results of handing off this question from Serf Burr to Wilhelm Damm. And so the result, because he was a philosopher and, of course, an author, on his part was one of his most interesting works. A direct addressing of the Jewish question. It's a translation and a new preface to Menashe ben Israel's Vindication of the Jews. Menashe ben Israel is a great character. Can't talk about him. 17th century. He was the rabbi of Amsterdam at a critical time. He was, if you're familiar, famous for his correspondence with Cromwell in his attempt to reintroduce the Jews into the British Isles. Menashe ben Israel. He believed that the Jews had to go back to England because once we were scattered to the four corners of the world, literally, because now in the 1650s we knew that it was a globe, right? Then the ingathering could begin again. And one of his early works was The Vindication of the Jews. It was an attempt to just simply point out to Christian society, hey, folks, we're not the devil. And it's a systematic approach. It wasn't just a polemic. And Mendelssohn thought it was time to sort of translate and republish this work, together with his preface. And his stance on the Jewish question was basically thank you, but no thank you. That if what is required of us, obviously he rejected the chew them up and spit them out perspective all along. That was just, but to Dom's approach, to a Jew is more of a man than a Jew. Therefore, to join society, all you have to do is stop being such a Jew. He said, no, this is not, not only do I reject it because I am a Jew, but on a deeper level, he rejects it because it's a corruption of the idea of Enlightenment philosophy. That you should make participation in society contingent upon abandoning your own culture was abhorrent to Mendelssohn. This is Mendelssohn, right? That he said that the first step, if a society wants to be Enlightenment, is simply ending all restrictions and discriminations imposed on the Jews. That's it. Full stop. Now, he did believe that the Jews themselves would willingly adopt the values of tolerance. Because remember, the Jews are not historically so loving to the Christians either, right? Sort of in response to the love, as he called it, which would be showered upon them, right? But he also makes two other important observations. Number one, it's a great quote. Says, it's curious to observe how prejudice assumes the forms of all ages on purpose to oppress us and puts obstacles in the way of our civil admission. Right? He just said in a much more eloquent fashion what I told you, which is that it seems that the exclusion of the Jews just takes whatever form is most effective in the age in which we find ourselves. Indigestible element of empire. That was pre-Christian Greco-Roman culture. Obstinate refuser of salvation. That's good for the Middle Ages, right? Then the alien other within society, right? By the way, the postmodern era, I'm not going to give it away now, but it's worth it to think about the fact that once again the Jews are experiencing some sense of exclusion which is wrapped up with our national re-embodiment, right? It's an important, on a level, it's just the story that doesn't fit. It's the story that won't play the relative game, right? But that's a discussion for another time. Here, Mendelssohn is just pointing out that, like, it's a little bit fishy. Kind of like I said to one of my students recently when she was explaining intersectionality theory to me. And I said, I couldn't help it. I said, wait, don't tell me. You have a theory that makes sense of everything in the world, and the victim is the Jew. I'm like, oh, I didn't see that one coming. Oh, shocker. You know, like, there is something slightly strange about these sort of new waves of reorganization of humanity that seem to have a consistent theme. And that's what Mendelssohn is pointing out, right? However, it's very important for our story, aside from that, which, like I said, doesn't end, that one doesn't end well for the Jews. For our story of the sort of the intra-Jewish narrative, there's a very important second point that he makes. And that is that the great barrier internally that Mendelssohn sees to joining Enlightenment society is the desire to maintain an autonomous communal structure. Mendelssohn says, you can't have your cake and eat it too. If you want to be part of Enlightenment society, you have to be a citizen. You have to be a German or a Frenchman or what have you, right? Now, you should also be a Jew. Remember, he's into the authority of the law, right? But he says no problem or contradiction between the two. You'll keep kosher, you'll keep Shabbos, you'll do what you need to do. But what you won't do is be part of a separate autonomous society that has its own rules and regulations, right? And so therefore, he pleads for freedom, right, against what he calls the avenging sword of rabbinic coercion, which madness only thinks it can manage surely. Right? And so this is a call on two fronts for enlightened freedom, that the nations should accept us as who we are without preconditions, and that we, not in turn, but on our own sort of recognizance, should become a community of faith where membership is voluntary and coercion is obsolete, right? This is the modern model of being a German of the Mosaic persuasion, right? This is the final step in the evolution of a Jewish religion. Now, today, everyone assumes that Judaism is a religion, right? But what he just pointed out to you is that truth is we maintained a national or collective, communal, racial status within Christian and Muslim society, as Chuck pointed out, for the whole Middle Ages. Now, again, these categories of religion, nation, people, race, they're very fishy categories. But I want you to understand from this is that the door to enlightenment even as what Mendelssohn's desire of, as an observant Jew, depended upon giving up the last communal national structures. It needed to be a community of faith. And ironically, that means you can have, on one hand, complete assimilation that goes hand in hand with strict Torah observance. Right? And what he's setting up is the opposition between the Jewish national revival and the religious community on both fronts. You know, they say that the one thing that managed to unite European Jewry from the extreme of the Reform movement to the extreme of the Orthodox movement was their opposition to Zionism. Right? It's an important observation. Right? Because both of those extremes of the spectrum felt very strongly that what it meant to be a Jew was a religion. It was a community of faith. Right? Why? Because they were trying to make their way as citizens within the state. They just disagreed on the question of the authority of the law. You understand? This is a very important evolution. Even though within the religious society they were unwilling to give up this coercive power that kept the social cohesion. So this is the Jewish problem, and it's a big one, as we know, because it's still in the news today. And for our purposes, the next stage will happen when I flip the page and find the right one. Here we go. Okay, so but our story is going to take a rather big turn. I can't decide which way to go. You know what? I'm going to do a side story to France, because we can't do everything. But I think it's very important to note that the process of emancipation, as long as we're on the topic, obviously doesn't stop in the German states. In fact, it doesn't really even reach its height there. Because in the early 1780s, so we'll have this edict of tolerance, and we'll have these sort of questions of the Jew checking their culture at the door. But in all truth, credit where credit is due, it's the French who are the first to confer citizenship upon the Jews.
A side question. Is there a Germany at the time already?
No. It's the German states. Germany doesn't come into being until the end of the 19th century. 1871 is the official. Yeah, like the Franco-Prussian War and all that. That's a much later phenomenon. Although it's fair to talk about a German culture, obviously. It's just not, for various reasons, I think people were invested in not having a strong, united German state behind that culture. So a citizen in this case would be a citizen of Prussia, Austria, Bavaria. It's a model of relationship, and that's what I encourage you to think about, is it's a model of relationship between power and the individual, as opposed to the absolute evolution into what we now know as the nation state.
Before we leave the Germanic states, I just want to say something.
Oh, we're coming back. Yeah, go ahead.
That's related, but not.
Okay, go ahead. The repressive law against Jews that were left over from the Middle Ages.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And restrictions on marriage and
absolutely restrictions on marriage and travel and residence and.
Okay, but that had an unintended consequence and a boon for the United States, because a lot of the young men, Jewish men, who couldn't marry because you had to wait, you had to get a license, you had to wait for years.
Sure.
They left and went to the United States and became the peddlers who became the.
Yes.
Later on.
Yeah, if people are familiar with American Jewish history, the first wave, the first wave was actually the Sephardic wave and the port Jews, etc. But the first wave that established what we know as the Jewish community today was the Germans in really the early 19th century. It's a little bit past where we are now, but thank you for that. Okay, France. So really, in a nutshell, I promise that, is that France actually doesn't have a Jewish problem up until about 1648. If you recall, France kicked the Jews out several times. That's how they took that other model, as we are familiar with, right? But in 1648, in their ongoing wars in the Rhineland, they once again annex Alsace and Lorraine from Austria, and they ended up with some tens of thousands of Ashkenazim. Now, it's very interesting. In France, there had been at the time several thousand, numbers I have here is 3,500, people who had Sephardim that had fled the persecutions in Spain, either before the expulsion, during, or they were conversos that had fled and returned to their Judaism. It's complex because, of course, France has a border with Spain and that whole area of Provence, the mingled culture there. But here's the thing, and this is important to understand. is that the Sephardim were what we would call today assimilated. Doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't keeping the Torah, but they looked French, they acted French, they spoke the local language, they were a participant in the economic life, right? They were considered to be cultured. Many of them were carriers of the Spanish culture, which had a lot of attraction to the French. French weren't afraid of, they didn't feel a need to disparage Spanish culture like they felt the need to disparage German culture. It was a little bit more welcoming. And so therefore, they looked right. Whereas the Ashkenazim that they inherited when they annexed Alsace and Lorraine, some 30, 40,000 of them, looked like Jews. They were living in ghetto culture, clearly distinguishable, in very restricted economic modes, right? Traditional big beards and the dress and all that. So therefore, obviously, you know, France, Louis XVI, is toppled by the revolution. Not going to go through the whole history. In 1789, the National Assembly constitutes itself. The National Assembly is the attempt to sort of create a new form of government for the French nation. And one of their probably most their most famous act is the Declaration of the Universal Rights of Man, right? Which has many, many articles, right? Just to give you a taste of them, article number one is men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions can be founded only in the on the common good. Number two, the goal of any political association is the conservation of the natural and imprescriptible, whatever that word means, rights of man. Number three, just hear the Enlightenment emancipation in this, the principle of any sovereignty resides essentially in the nation. No body, no individual can assert authority which does not emanate precisely from it. This is classic Enlightenment now embodied in what is rapidly becoming a nation state. And for our purposes, it's really the first article that matters. Because if men are born and remain free and equal in rights, is that true of the Jews? Now, you would think it sounds obvious, but you would be wrong. Because the first attempt to extend the Declaration of the Rights of the Man to the Jews happened only a few months after its publication. Somebody was going to bring it up, but it was tabled due to lack of support. Right? There are all kinds of struggles. If you're familiar with the history of the French Revolution, it didn't go smoothly. And the Jews were, of course, still involved in sort of their problematic economic role in money lending, which doesn't create a great sense of love between, right, that's the whole neither lender nor borrower be. So there will be a constant struggle. Within a few months of that original attempt, advocates for the topic did succeed in getting citizenship for the so-called Portuguese or Spanish Jews, and the decisive argument was the one that I gave you, that they were already culturally and socially French. They looked French, they spoke French, they participated in the economic life, what was deemed to be productive economic life of the country. For 2 years, the assembly sat and worked through many issues. The Jews were not high on the list, mind you, right? But they worked through many issues, right? And periodically, this question of extending the universal rights of humanity to the Ashkenazi Jews came up and was tabled for lack of support. They were seen to just simply be parasites on society, right? Here's a great one for you. One delegate describes, I observe, first of all, that the word Jew is not the name of a sect, but of a nation that has laws which it has always followed and still wishes to follow. Calling Jews citizens would be like saying that without letters of naturalization, without ceasing to be English or Danish, the English and Danish could become French. The Jew is simply other. They're not French. Now, where this Jewish nation resides, we don't know, but certainly not here, says this probably a young man, frankly, in the National Assembly. But finally, in the closing days of the National Assembly, I'm going to mangle his name. I'll just call him Duport, made the following declaration. 1791. I believe that freedom of worship no longer permits any distinction to be made between the political rights of citizens on the basis of their beliefs. I believe equally that the Jews cannot be the only exception to the enjoyment of these rights. When pagans, Turks, Muslims, Chinese even, men of all the sects, in short, are admitted to these rights. In other words, the revolution was hoisted on its own petard. Remember that there was a deeply philosophical stance of the revolution, which is that Duport's argument is that you can't have a revolution that declares the universal rights of man and leave people out. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And he ends up carrying the day. This is, in the end of the day, the argument that carries the day. I'm going to just write it up. because I've embarrassed myself. Jean-François Duport. Hang on. C-O. Right? To complete the revolution, the Jews have to be set free. Not because they necessarily deserve it or we want them, but because it just simply doesn't work. I can't speak to numbers because I don't know, but I think that there's just too long a history of animosity, plus the very real fact that Montesquieu would point out to us that the Jews had been pushed into what were perceived as an unhealthy economic role. Don't disvalue the economic role here. If we had time and we got to Marx, we would discover that Marx, who was, let's just say, not the greatest lover of the Jews ever, his arguments were economic. That the Jew was a parasite and the expression of the sort of ultimate extension of capitalism, right? And so the economic piece plays a very important role.
I was just going to say, I know this comes later, but this is also very intrinsic to the problem. The problem of dual loyalty.
The problem of dual loyalty will come later, but you are correct, although you saw it raised here in the sense that giving the Jews citizenship would be like giving the English citizenship. They belong somewhere else. Right, as long as it's not here. That's just in a nutshell. Of course, the National Assembly gives the Jews citizenship. It's important to do the Hakarat HaTov. France is the first nation in Europe which extends full citizenship to the Jews, and it's full. Again, culturally and socially, that's its own challenge. But legally, it is a full citizenship. And of course, the revolution either fails or succeeds in its sort of production of Napoleon, depending on how you understand the revolution in French history, and it will be Napoleon who takes that ideal throughout Europe, because Napoleon, of course, is the great mixing spoon of European political culture. And so there's much to be said about that, but not in our story now. I just wanted to make sure we gave credit where credit is due in that piece. Okay. Yes? That was Napoleon, though. That was Napoleon. It was a product of Napoleon's culture. That's why I can't go there now. Okay, back to the Jews, right? So, because Mendelssohn's still alive, although he's getting old, and he's progressively actually, his heart is breaking further and further. And one can make an argument that the thing which really broke Mendelssohn's heart is the same event that really birthed a true movement out of the Berlin Enlightenment. You know, through probably the latter half of his life, Mendelssohn was involved in a translation of the Torah into German, right? He says basically that, as it says, when God gave in his grace gave me sons, and the time arrived to teach them the Torah, I took it upon myself to translate the Torah into a decorous and refined German, such as is used in our time. That's from his introduction, what's called the Biur, which is Mendelssohn's translation and commentary into German on the Torah. It's not all by him. It became a project, which is why it, in many ways, is the beginning of the Berlin Enlightenment. He gathered other Enlightenment scholars, Jewish scholars, many of whom were very traditional like him in their practice, but were attempting to build a bridge between traditional Jewish culture and German Enlightenment culture. And you should understand in this act that Mendelssohn belongs to a very elite club in Jewish history. Right? We have the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. There are a couple of Greek translations of the Hebrew Bible. But the Septuagint is probably the best known. And even though the Septuagint becomes a Christian text, ultimately, it was originally translated for Jews, by Jews, whatever. We have the Targum, several of them into Aramaic, right? We have Rav Sadia Gaon's translation into Arabic, which a lot of sort of Ashkenazi Western culture Jews are unaware of its incredible significance for Jewish history. In linguistically opening the door between Arabic and Hebrew, which it almost single-handedly gave birth to Hebrew philology, to the study of the Hebrew language in a scientific fashion. We spoke about it this past semester, huge significance. But one of these things all share is that they're a cultural bridge. And bridges work two ways, right? And if there's a desire to sort of bring Enlightenment culture into the Jewish world, which is what Mendelssohn desired to do, Well, once that bridge is open, you're also going to have Jewish culture going out. Now, if you believe that you will be, as we call, a mashpia and not mushpa, if you think that your impact will be in influencing others and not in yourself being influenced, so that's great. That's our whole purpose, right? If we get to the Baal Shem Tov, we'll speak about the fact that that was his great vision, that he should spread his waters outwards, right? But at this point, what's unique and what separates Mendelssohn's translation from Rav Saadia's and the Septuagint and the Targum is that there were very few Jews who actually read German in his day. Rav Saadia was meeting a need. The Septuagint was meeting, there was Hellenistic Judaism, there were a whole class of Jews who didn't even read Hebrew, right? But there were very few Jews who read German. So their vernacular was Yiddish, and the classic language of prayer and study was Hebrew. And Mendelssohn makes very clear his goals for the translation in the introduction. He wanted to set European Jews free from the flaws he perceived in the Yiddish translations, and he wanted to combat non-Jewish and even anti-Jewish biases that in the existing German translations. Of course, the first German translation of the Bible famously was Luther, right? Who was no lover of the Jews either. And his translation, by the way, helped to give birth to the modern German language. So he had a tremendous impact on German culture. So there was a third goal, though, that he kind of left unstated, but which he made clear to a letter in a Dutch friend, that he wanted to open the gates of the German language and the Enlightenment to the Jews of his day. Because remember, Mendelssohn was always fighting the battle on both fronts. He wanted society to accept the Jews as Jews, and he wanted the Jews to accept society as society. In its Enlightenment refined form, of course. He wasn't interested in anything else. So he gathered around him a group of scholars, as I said. Interestingly enough, you know, in that era, and to this very day, then you published almost nothing without what we call a haskama. Right? A rabbinic letter of approbation. And so they turned to one of the leading rabbinic authorities of the day, the Notabi Yehuda. It was the Rav of Prague. But the Notabi Yehuda, Rav Yechezkel Landau, declined to put his name on this. Not because of the scholarship per se. He had his doubts about Mendelssohn's loyalty to Torah. There's a famous story I didn't tell you, but in a very brief nutshell, back in 1772, the Duke Frederick had ordered that no body upon his estates, which I forget exactly where he ruled in the German states, but it was a large area, would be buried until 72 hours had elapsed after its death. There was a concern at the time among scientists and doctors that the diagnosis of death was inaccurate at best. So therefore, that they were afraid of the phenomenon of being buried alive, which I would support you. I don't want to be buried alive in that, right? However, if you're familiar with that, classically Jewish law mandates burial immediately upon death, right? And so therefore, there was a conflict over this, and it's a classic conflict between science and tradition, right? And somehow, Mendelssohn was drawn into this battle between the rabbis and the secular authorities, right? And he took a very public stance, Mendelssohn, on the side of law and science against tradition. Now, which is more than, now again, people who are familiar with halachic discourse, you know that such a position is not outrageous. Maybe he had really good arguments. I haven't read his tshuva. He wrote a proper response on the question. But that wasn't the issue. The issue was taking a public stance on one side or the other. And I want you to hear that as like a warning shot in a battle which is now erupting throughout Europe. And it's just beginning, but it's gonna consume European Jewry, which is, whose side you're on is going to matter more than whether what you're saying is right or wrong. Now, this is obviously nothing new, but particularly this sort of battle between the communal loyalty to the authority of tradition embodied in a set of rabbis versus sort of enlightenment freedom to figure out what you think is right, which, by the way, might be based in a deep engagement of Jewish sources, but if you're breaking ranks, then you're taking the wrong side, right? This is going to tear European Jewry apart. And frankly, that rift has not been healed to today. So therefore, the Notabi Yehuda said, I think I'll leave my name off your book. Mendelssohn? He was always, not always, at the end, because that was 1772, and he's only going to live another 10, 12 years, they started to suspect him. The turning point was this battle over burial. As I pointed out to you, Rav Yonatan Eibschitz refused to give him smicha, to give him ordination, because he was skeptical of his philosophical mastery. At the same time, everybody valued, he was a tremendous defender of the Jews. And there was, I think, some justifiable pride in the sense that, like, yeah, we can play your game too. Look, he was one of the most important philosophers of the German Enlightenment, not just amongst the Jews. As a philosopher, I told you that Phaedon, his defense of the simplicity and immortality of the soul, was literally a bestseller throughout Europe. I mean, and so there was a sense that, like, oh, yeah, we can do this too, and they're proud. At the same time, people began to sense quickly that again, a bridge works in two directions. And even if he, to his dying day, not only vehemently defended the binding nature of the law, but personally embodied it, those who came after him did not. And the real break is going to happen in a second. You had a question, comment. Who was the rabbi who refused to put his name? It was Rabbi Chezkel Landau. It was called the Notabi Yehuda. It was a very important figure in Prague toward the end of the 18th century. Who did Jews carry umbrellas on Shabbat? I can hear some laughter from those who grew up in the Orthodox world. And the reason that you do not is the Notabi Yehuda. By the way, if you ever want to talk about that, we can talk about it. You just want to appreciate the Notabi Yehuda fought the battles of the early Enlightenment against this Enlightenment culture. And just to tell you, this whole umbrella thing, some of you are probably wondering, what is he talking about? The vehemence around the question of the umbrella begins with the Notabi Yehuda and his perception that only an enlightened Jew who was at one foot out the door would promenade down, wait, what river runs through Prague? The Volga? The Danube, okay. He would promenade down the Danube with a parasol on Saturday, right? There's a lot more to be said about that, but that's just to locate the Notabi Yehuda in our story here. As far as I know, Mendelssohn did not write or comment publicly about the issue of Christianity within his family, but I am not a master of the extent of his writings, so I would not claim to say yes or no on that. I do not know. Yeah, my suspicion is that was probably the case, that they didn't, that the conversions happened after his death. But our time is short, and the master is pressing, so I want to get to this. I want to get to the real birth of the German Enlightenment amongst the Jews. They around the Biur, around this project of translating and commenting on the Chumash, gathered a group of scholars. And amongst them was Naftali Hertz Wellesley, poet, translator, commentator, right? And by the way, personally belonged really to the traditional side of what's becoming a growing divide. But Wellesley was plagued by one thought. He says, ignorance has become widespread amongst our people. So they know not, nor do they comprehend, the difference between the teaching of the ancients and the teaching of the later generations. They think it's simply a simple matter to study the Bible. Right? In our day, I see this a lot in my students who grow up in the Orthodox world who don't know that the story about Abraham who smashed the idols is not actually in the Torah. Anybody here was shocked when they discovered that growing up? Right? Meaning there is a packaging that happens within traditional Judaism as if it were one monolithic item. Now, part of that is just limitations of education, and not everybody's a great teacher. But Wellesley also had a suspicion. Wesley, yeah, not Wellesley. Wesley, who was he? Yeah. I haven't explained it yet. I'm going to tell you. He had a suspicion that this is also bound up with rabbinic authority, because if what the Notabi Yehuda writes in the 18th century is part and parcel of what the Gemara said in the 6th century, which is part and parcel of what God said, 3,300-odd years ago at Sinai, then you can't argue with the Notabi Yehuda, because if you argue with the Notabi Yehuda, you're arguing with God. You see the problem, or the power, as the case may be? So Naftali Hertz Wellesley was part of this circle who gathered around Moses Mendelssohn and the project of the Biur. And he, in particular, like I said, was troubled by the educational challenge. And so he began to lash out, both personally and in writing, at the inability of religious teachers to teach at all as a methodology, which is a big part of Enlightenment philosophy, sort of proper education, which we should all be grateful for, right? What he saw to be a mistaken emphasis on the Talmud in particular, and he blamed the rabbis. So the rabbis are responsible for the low state of Jewish education, right? And so therefore, he writes an essay, right? I have a lot of notes in there. He writes an essay in 1782 called Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, Words of Peace and Truth. But those who are familiar know that peace and truth don't often go together. And this was not received so peacefully, even if people were willing to call it true. It's a polemic. It's an argument that he is making for, it is really the first presented vision of an Enlightenment Jewish education, which was produced what we now call the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, right? This is what's called the Berlin Enlightenment, even though the Berlin Enlightenment is short-lived. And when people think of the Haskalah, they usually think of efforts moved to Galicia, and it's going over east, and the classic names people are more familiar with probably are there. Nevertheless, its roots are here, and I think for understanding things, I'm always a fan of getting to their roots. So in this pamphlet of the words of peace and truth, so Wellesley makes a distinction what he calls the Torah Adam, human knowledge, and Torah Hashem, right, divine knowledge. And human knowledge, of course, based on sort of like any subject which is necessary to understand the relationship between man and man, science, history, everything which is common to the human race, right? As opposed to the divine teachings, which are based on the Torah, which he sees as binding, and are therefore the inheritance of the Jewish people alone. Now the question is, mi berosh, what comes first? What is the most critical element? And he says proper Jewish education not only must incorporate both, but that Torah Adam must precede education in Torah Hashem. That human knowledge should be the foundation of one's learning, which is then built upon which you will find divine knowledge. Because without general education, he goes so far as to say, you can't understand the Torah. And he's not alone in this. By the way, you could find, and he did find, classic sources going back quite far in our tradition that recognize that general knowledge is a sort of absolute necessary precursor to understanding the Torah, right? But he went a step further. He said a Jew could be part of humanity if he lacks knowledge of the Torah but got a general education. But a Jew can't be a Jew if he doesn't have secular knowledge, no matter how much Torah he knows. And it, in one phrase, basically takes aim at all of traditional Judaism in Europe. So that's why you can imagine, and this book, this wasn't a book, it was a pamphlet, was published as a direct appeal to rabbis and community leaders to basically bring freedom to Jewish community by voluntarily establishing a system of reformed Jewish schools. Now it's important, 1782 is the year in which it was written. What else happened in 1782? The Edict of Tolerance, right? The Edict of Tolerance within Austria. Wellesley's pamphlet is a direct response, because remember, the Edict of Tolerance, one of its goals was to set up schools in which Jews could study secular education. And Wellesley was basically saying to the rabbis and community leaders, we need to do this, not because we're being forced to by an enlightened despot, but because in order to be Jews, we need to do this. Right? It's no longer a utilitarian, listen, you got to make a living, and we want entry into society, so we have to learn their languages and master their skills so we can all go to law school. No, this is, if you actually want to be a Jew properly, you have to do this now. And of course, indirectly but quite strongly, criticizing the entire model of European Jewry, which exists up until that day. To say that it was explosive is a gross understatement. Servants preached across Europe, right? He was an unordained Jew. He wasn't a rabbi. So his presumption to usurp rabbinic authority was seen as much of a threat as his sort of crazy, dangerous idea of introducing this Enlightenment educational ideal and dealing a mortal blow to the sort of sacred task of Torah study, right? And what's interesting is that the vilification of Mendelssohn, which comes down to us through history, because most people have never heard of Naftali Herz Wellesley, right? The vilification of Mendelssohn in many ways was because of his defense of Wellesley. Mendelssohn was heartbroken by the response, because of course, Wellesley just said what he'd been saying all along, was that is a two-step process. We need entree into society, and we need to let society into us. And Wellesley said, good, now I'll tell you how to do it. Education is the chief power. It was one of the great sort of insights of the Enlightenment, was that education is power and freedom, right? The Nota Behuda writes, when the pamphlet was published, that together with the preface to Menashe Ben Israel's book that I told you that Mendelssohn wrote, where he took aim at rabbinic authority, and his defense of Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, he says, "Now I see that every offense we found him to be guilty of was true," speaking about Mendelssohn. "He has declared himself that he has no share in the God of Israel, nor his Torah, and that every man may do as his heart desires." Right? This was the decisive turning point away from Mendelssohn, and therefore in many ways by traditional Judaism away from the model which he was attempting to offer, which was that one can be both a Jew and a member of society. And what will grow from here on out is this sense that you must choose, right? That you can be a Jew or you can be a member of society, and that you cannot have them both. And that on one hand, the traditional structures of religious Jewry will attempt to draw you back in if you break out through the tools of coercion. On the other hand, to be enlightened means to fight against those structures, even if you may agree with the authority which of law which underlies them. Right? And of course, you can't really undermine structures without, in the end of the day, undermining the law. Right? You know, and that's a longer discussion that we'll speak about when we speak about the reform movement. So in the last few, about 15 minutes, I'm going to map out sort of what lays on the horizon here. Because Divrei Shalom Ve'emet is, like I said, really the turning point in the birth of a Berlin Enlightenment, a self-conscious movement of young men. They were, as far as I know, all men, which is not uncommon for 18th century European society, who saw themselves as involved in this sacred task of first of all, bridging between Enlightenment culture and Judaism, and then reforming from within a culture that they felt, remember, their goal is to be better Jews, a culture which they felt had basically stagnated due to ignorance or the overabundance of rabbinic power. And it's hard to emphasize enough as well, and the piece I haven't said as much, somebody brought it up to me at the end of class last week, they also had a tremendous desire to be part of the world. They felt trapped in their Judaism. Now, they wanted to be Jews, so they therefore were fighting this two-pronged battle to be accepted into society as Jews and to reform from within their Jewish society so they wouldn't be ashamed of being part of it and they would be free to be Jews, right? But that the desire to enter into society was a driving psychological desire, and it's one that which just needs to be recognized, and I don't know if honored is the right word, but just given its proper importance. Because I'm a believer, those of us, we've been learning together for a while, you've heard me say it probably 1,000 times, that psychology is the driving force for most people's behavior. Most people are not moved by ideas, right? And one of the most powerful sort of drivers of psychology is the need for belonging, right? Now, it's not true for everyone, and there's also an opposite power of the power of it, of being an outlier, right? But for the Jews in Europe, the tension between being an outlier and the desire for belonging is a characteristic tension, right? And so that it plays a big role in this formation of a group of young men who will eventually actually gain the self-awareness as a movement. But we're going to give Mendelssohn his last gasp. Mendelssohn, at the end of his life, in response to both this sort of uproar around Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, as well as his response to Dohm's essay about the Jews checking their culture at the door. Furthermore, there's another piece on the horizon, which is that the Romantic movement has already begun within Germany by the end of the 1780s. Right? And the Romantic movement, which will begin to move away from pure reason as the standard of measure for human behavior and reintroduce the powers of emotion and creativity and the intensity of experience as standards of measure, right? Mendelssohn is deeply frightened by the dark gods that he sees underlying the Romantic movement, right? His vision is a classic Enlightenment movement vision, that philosophy will set us free and that reason is what makes us human, and that all these other passions, and by the way, as opposed to the Enlightenment philosophers who wanted to skip over the Middle Ages and were classicists, the Romantic movement will look back to the medieval era as a tremendous source of vigor and health, right? It had its earliest roots in Germany, one of the German states. And so therefore, he was experiencing its movements. He was the end of the Enlightenment era. And so therefore, his life ended in a very sort of sad and somewhat intellectually broken fashion, which may have a lot to do with the conversions that people have brought up. And his last work, of course, is Jerusalem. Right? Jerusalem is, or On Religious Power in Judaism, was compiled over a period of 8 months at the end of 1782, the height of the storm around Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. And it was his articulation of how he believed Jewish identity was both binding and nevertheless compatible with religious tolerance and could therefore be reconciled with the modern era. Everything we've spoken up till now. And he says, you know, every civil society would do well to let neither prejudice, nor neither fanaticism nor atheism take root and spread. Right? He's afraid of the two poles. And by the way, this is something that we should take to heart in our era. It seems we're always being presented with these dichotomies. You can either have fanaticism or atheism. Right? He was always trying to hold the middle in that thought. I'm not going to go to I have all these details on Jerusalem. The truth of the matter is, it's not worth it. You know why? Because when he wrote it, nobody cared. It was too late. In fact, it was got almost no response. Later, it will be translated into Hebrew by the next generation of the Berlin Enlightenment and held up as a manifesto, which is, again, as I told you, how Mendelssohn really became emblematic of the Jewish Enlightenment and therefore was associated with their later sort of more profound break with traditional culture. He himself in his own life was, to his dying day, a deeply committed Jew, committed to being a Jew, and committed to the reality of an ability to live within European Enlightenment society. But Jerusalem was published in German and hardly read because he had already really been surpassed by the next wave which was to come, and that was what really is known as the German Enlightenment in its proper sense. So there's about 5 minutes left. I think I'll give you time for any questions, and then I'll set the stage for the phase that lay ahead. Questions, comments, yeah? What was required of people who converted? Oh, you mean people who converted to Christianity? I'm not an expert in Christianity. I don't think I would feel comfortable answering that question. My knowledge of history is what was required for people who converted was first and foremost to stop being a Jew. Meaning you no longer were socially or in practice a Jew. And then, you know, I think it probably varied in the society and the nature of the church that they joined. Catholicism obviously is a much more legally oriented culture within Christianity than, say, the Protestant movements. But I'm not really qualified to answer that question. Yeah.
Given that Mendelssohn remained a committed, quote-unquote, Orthodox Jew, then why is his name so associated with the Reform movement?
So given that he remained a traditional Jew, why is he associated with the Reform movement? We've touched that question. It's because he becomes an emblem within the Berlin Enlightenment. Remember, as I pointed out to you guys, there's history and then there's the history of reception. I mean, there's who Mendelssohn actually was and what he did, and then there's how his memory and his image was received through the ages. So we're not going to do it now, but there's a young man whose last name is Eichel, and first name is evading me right now, who really begins what's called the Maasif. It's the journal of the Hebrew culture and the Berlin Enlightenment. He's the one that holds up Mendelssohn as emblematic of Jewish Enlightenment, and that whole movement is associated with the Reform movement. So Mendelssohn, after his death, is brought in as the sort of father figure. Other questions or comments?
Can you say more about the book Jerusalem?
More about the book Jerusalem? I mean, as I said, it's a defense of his final vision. The only sort of piece I would add is the sort of great fear that he has that in his desire to keep church and state separate, that the Romantic movement is a tremendous threat. He doesn't call it the Romantic movement, obviously, because that's like a post facto designation. But this sort of return to the irrational, which he sees always threatening humanity. By the way, as a parallel, what's happening in the Jewish world at this point over in Eastern Europe? Hasidut, which we're going to have to bring up next week, because that is the romantic expression of a deeply authentic Jewish experience, and it's one which will be a direct competitor for a lot of the youth of the day against the Haskalah.
if you didn't have assimilation. Everyone thinks assimilation is the answer, but it always goes back and kicks us in the butt.
Do I see assimilation as spurring further anti-Semitism? It's too big a question to answer right now. I'm sorry. I'd say that's a fundamental question within Jewish history. Yeah, that discussion of whether you're Jewish American or American Jew is passé. It is a product of up until my generation. When I was in a youth group, we used to have that discussion. I promise you that my students are no longer having it. It is passé. The whole hyphenated identity thing is out. We can talk about it at some other time. But in my humble opinion, does not bode well for the continuity and richness of Jewish tradition in America. Other questions or comments? Okay, on that happy note then, we can always end a minute or two early. And just remember, if you guys want to be in touch, you got the information there. If people have questions about the podcast or these classes, you can let me know. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit almad.pardes.org.